Our third case this morning is number 04-1139 and 04-1311. Van Dyke Johnson against Stephen Dougherty, Robert L. McIntyre, and Don Hinderleiter, et al.
Good morning, Your Honors. It please the Court. My name is Marek Dedina. I represent the appellant Van Dyke Johnson. This case arises under Section 1983 and the Eighth Amendment from the consistent refusal to recommend and authorize surgical treatment of Van Dyke Johnson inguinal hernia by the physicians and officials of the Illinois Department of Corrections. We are asking for reversal of the lower court's decision and new trial for three reasons. First, the district court abuses discretion when, in light of the merit and medical complexity of this case, it refused to appoint counsel to Johnson until after the judgment was entered. Second, the lower court committed a clear error by discounting Johnson's chronic hernia pain and restricted movement as insufficient reasons to find deliberate indifference of the prison physicians. And eventually, third, the trial court erred in dismissing the Illinois Department of Corrections officials, even though they became aware of the physician's response, that the physician's response was totally ineffective in relieving Johnson's pain and disability, and they at least condoned the practice of denying hernia surgery in non-emergency situations. Let me begin with the denial of counsel. This court often finds counsel necessary where a meritorious case involves complex medical issues. This case presented obvious merits since its very inception. It was always beyond the dispute that Mr. Johnson suffered from hernia. However, although my client's intestine protruded from his abdominal cavity, all three physicians denied surgery as long as he could push them back, because the physicians concluded that the case of Johnson did not pose an emergency conditions, despite his substantial chronic pain. This is a medical case, and Johnson needed to show, in order to establish his case, that no minimally competent physician would respond to the patient's constant complaints of pain by instructing him to wear the truss, take the constipation medicine, or mild pain medicine. Here, medical experts' testimony was needed to establish the essential elements of Johnson's deliberate indifference claim that is at the heart of this case, namely the minimum accepted medical practice and the very substantial departure from that standard. The lack of legal representation empowered to hire an expert placed Johnson at considerable disadvantage at trial, and the adversary, represented by three trial attorneys, supported by the expert testimony of defendant physicians, took every advantage of the situation. The counsel should have been appointed here to rectify this misbalance. In fact, the district court belatedly realized that error, namely in the last order denying counsel to Johnson that the court entered in August.
Well, that's when he admitted it, the judge admitted he saw the complexity. But he must have realized it earlier, didn't he? Before he tried this matter, he must have known what issues were going to be tried.
Yes. All the orders denying counsel stated that the case's complexity did not rise to the level that would justify appointment of counsel. Only in its final order, after the trial was already concluded, the district court concluded that there was complexity and merits to this case.
You refresh my recollection, counsel. When was the first motion for appointment of counsel made?
The first motion for the appointment of counsel was made in December 2001. It was denied in January 2002.
And at what stage of the proceedings were things at that point?
It was before, it was very initial stage of proceedings. It was before the motion for, the motion to dismiss was denied. After the motion to dismiss was denied, Mr. Johnson, in summer of 2002, in about August, he filed his second motion for the appointment of counsel.
It was by the time the judge got around to trying this case, he knew the plaintiff thought he needed a lawyer.
Yes.
And the judge also, by that time, must have known what issues were going to be tried.
Yes. In fact, in the third order denying counsel, the judge justified that Mr. Johnson could testify to his own pain and limited movement.
Did Mr. Johnson try to get private counsel?
Yes, Mr. Johnson sent letters to several counsel, and eight of them responded that denied Mr. Johnson's request for counsel. I think that Mr. Johnson undertook reasonable measures to provide the counsel for himself, but he was unable to. After when the district court denied new trial to Johnson, district court said that the plaintiff did not counter the treating doctor's expert testimony, even though the doctor acknowledged that the preventive treatment would not cure Johnson's hernia. So this is contradiction of the court's statement that was made in its last order denying counsel, where the court assumed that Johnson would be able to proceed against doctors just based on his own testimony. This implicitly admits that even the district court realized that an expert was necessary in this case.
One of the issues was the persistency and the severity of pain, am I right?
Yes. That the severity and persistence of this of the pain are at the heart of this case.
You say the district court said that he could rely simply on his own testimony.
Yes.
So he really didn't have a chance to bring any testimony before the court from members of the medical profession as to exactly whether those his protestations of pain fit the profile for this particular condition.
Yes, and Mr. Johnson advised regularly in all his three motions for the appointment of counsel that he was unable to come up with medical evidence that would refute the expert testimony of the defendant physicians.
Would you bring me up to date? Is he still in prison?
Yes, he is still in prison.
You ever have the operation?
No, he's still suffering from hernia. Actually, the hernia increased to the size of the baseball now.
When's he scheduled for release?
The parole hearing is scheduled for the March 23rd this year, 2005.
Did the at trial? Did the plaintiff attempt to deal with the possibility that the state was just trying to talk this whole problem to death? In other words, just keep it going until he was released and it became somebody else's problem. Did he try to approach that at all during the proceedings?
I think he pointed out to Dr. Hindeleiter's statements that instructed him to wait until release with dealing with the problem of hernia. However, we don't have a testimony of Dr. Hindeleiter because the district court did not sort of discourage actually Johnson from questioning Hinderleiter.
How did he discourage him?
Yes, actually, the district court actually asked very suggestive leading questions. Like, do you have any questions beyond the issue that Dr. Hinderleiter saw you only once? And apparently Johnson could not come up right away with any other ideas or issues that he would like to question Hinderleiter for. Counsel would be very handy here.
Is there any evidence in the record of the possibilities of complications from leaving this kind of condition?
Yes. Actually, Dr. McIntyre stated that this condition can become aggravated, that when the hernia becomes irreducible, meaning you cannot push it back, that can cause gangrene and medical emergency, a life-threatening situation. And actually, I think that's what Dr. McIntyre was looking for when
he examined. What does the record show, if anything, about the usual response of a competent physician when a patient presents with these symptoms?
Johnson unsuccessfully attempted to submit a piece of popular medical guide that was discharged as inadmissible hearsay by the district court.
That was the Good Housekeeping?
Good Housekeeping, yes.
And why was it inadmissible hearsay, did the judge say?
The judge said that it would not be admissible at trial as evidence, therefore it's not admissible at summary judgment.
Was he able to use that article or any other information he had gathered when he was examining the doctors, the experts? For instance, could he refer to whatever was referred to in the article, technical stuff that is listed as, was one word strangulation or something like that, whatever they call it, where it is no longer reducible?
Yes, and when the blood,
gangrene. Did he discuss that at all with the doctors? They must have said something about it when it reaches a certain stage.
There was a general testimony concerning strangulation, and Johnson tried to proceed on that issue, asking question about the risks of strangulations, and I think the district court at a certain point stopped that questioning, stating that Dr. McIntyre never actually diagnosed strangulation or any risk of life, so that is only hypothetical question here.
Well, it was an eventuality, a possible eventuality. It's something that could develop, though. The doctor did testify to that, didn't he?
Yes, the doctor said that there is a possibility, there is always a danger that the hernia can develop into a strangulated stage, where there is a medical emergency and life-threatening situation, surgery would be mandated, and that under their own practice of policy was one of the two circumstances, the only circumstances that the surgery would be provided. One, if there was strangulation, life threat. Two, if the prisoner would not be able to function on a day-to-day basis. Two testimonies.
And he testified that he basically wasn't able to function on a day-to-day basis, didn't he?
Yes, actually, if we look carefully at the testimony of Johnson and the findings of the district court, he was in constant pain. He visited a medical unit at least 15 times, and at each time it was pain-related. He suffered pain when coughing, sneezing, attending to his physiological needs, and the district court found that Johnson was not a malingerer, so there was serious pain, And Johnson testified that the mild treatment that he received did not have any effect, did not help him. It was ineffective. And he informed at least McIntyre, because he saw him several times, that...
Counsel, you also had the Department of Corrections employees. Why weren't they able to rely on the expert testimony or expertise of the physicians?
Your Honor, my client complained about the policy of IDOC. He stated that IDOC would not allow Dr. Hinderleiter to prescribe surgery for him. And the response to that complaint was that Hinderleiter did not see that it was that he did not see a medical emergency for the surgery. So, first, the response was within the framework of the policy, and the response was provided by the very person that my client complained of. It did not address the issue whether there is a policy that IDOC doctors comply with by refusing surgery. Therefore, I find this response woefully inadequate, whereby at least they condone the policy that has been in effect in the prison.
Thank you, Counselor.
If there are further questions, I would like to conclude.
Thank you. Because of our questions, Counsel, you have used all of your time. I do plan to give you 2 minutes for rebuttal to compensate for our questions. And, Counsel, your side has 2 additional minutes as well.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Good morning. My name is Craig Unrath. I represent the defendant physicians. At the outset, I'd like to point out that the determination as to whether counsel should have been appointed in this case or requested to represent the plaintiff is secondary. The primary issue in this case is whether the case has merit.
Why is it secondary?
Because if the case does not state a claim for deliberate indifference under the Eighth Amendment, then it makes no difference whether he had counsel or not.
But how do we know that if the man wasn't able to develop his case?
We know that because the Supreme Court has set a standard that only those deprivations denying the minimal civilized measure of life's necessities are sufficiently grave to implicate the Eighth Amendment.
This seems to be the point the district court missed as well. The court has held that persistent, severe pain constitutes a violation of the Eighth Amendment. The man may not have died at this, but he was going to be in agony for a long time. Why isn't that a violation of the Eighth Amendment?
It's not a violation of the Eighth Amendment because the severity of his pain is his subjective report. He was examined by numerous physicians on numerous occasions, was never found to be in acute distress. Judge Baker himself saw him at trial for an entire afternoon. He had the ability to review whether this man appeared to be in acute distress.
Doesn't this come back, though, to the appointment of counsel issue? In other words, as I review this case, it's continually bothered me. What are you going to? How does a prisoner develop at trial the subjective element that he had to develop here of showing that that your client in fact did have the subjective element of showing deliberate indifference to all of his pain?
He can establish this by testifying to his own pain, his limitations, and the effect of the hernia on his life.
Now, do you know of any other case or any other milieu in the United States where someone would realistically come to court with a complaint of pain and rely simply on their own testimony with respect to it?
I think that in most cases that they are going to be bringing in an expert to establish that pain. However, Your Honor, we are dealing with literally thousands of prisoner cases filed each year. If this is the sole standard, if on a medical claim for medical indifference to a serious medical need, that he is incapable of doing this without an expert, therefore he requires counsel, then we had better get our law firms in this state ready to represent a lot of prisoner cases.
Before we all go to general quarters, the fact of the matter is, though, this man came up with an undisputable diagnosis of a condition that normally causes persistent, excruciating pain. Most of the prisoner cases that we see around here, that cannot be done. Here, it clearly is. It's not even on the table. There's no one's disputing it.
I would disagree with one crucial aspect of your comment, Your Honor, is that you said that this will likely cause great pain. We don't know that. Testimony at trial developed that there are oftentimes inguinal hernias that cause no pain at all, or that pain is manageable. Now, I'd like to refer to a case that was relied.
What did they prescribe for this fellow?
Tylenol, Metamucil, Tums, and a hernia. A truss. It was a reducible hernia. The truss kept it reduced.
Tums, Metamucil, and Tylenol.
That's correct, Your Honor.
And if this had happened outside any place but your prison system, how would this have been handled?
Outside the prison system, Your Honor, had the patient insisted on it, he likely would have been referred to a surgeon, and that testimony was presented at trial. At the same time,
you're telling me that there is evidence in this record that that would not be the normal course of proceeding in the medical community of the United States?
Yes, there is. Dr. McIntyre testified that he would advise his patient of the risks of surgery and that the possibility of recurrence, and that many patients decide not to have that operation. That evidence is in the record. A case relied upon in plaintiff's brief, Delker v. Moss, stands for the proposition that prisons need not provide surgery for every single hernia. Rather, they must give due consideration to the unique facts of each case. That is precisely what has occurred in this case. They've reviewed him. They've looked at his particular case and found that he is in no acute distress. Now, plaintiff admitted at trial that some people get hernias, some people don't. Right there, what that indicates is this, is that the physicians on staff are making a determination on a case-by-case basis, and that means that they are not indifferent. It's all that the law requires. If there are no further questions, we ask that the judgment be affirmed, and I'd like to turn this over to my co-counsel to discuss the government defendants.
Thank you, Mr. McGrath. Mr. Legner.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. My name is Brett Legner. I'm an Assistant Attorney General, and I represent the DOC defendants in this case. First, I'd like to touch on, go back to the appointment of counsel issue briefly, if I may. And I'd like to remind this Court that the standard we're dealing with here is whether the district court abused its discretion, whether its decision was unreasonable at the time it made its decision of whether appointment of counsel was justified.
But that decision can be revisited at any time during the litigation, can it not, counsel?
And it was frequently revisited
in
this case.
And then why didn't the district court, at least at the time he went to trial, understand what kind of issues were going to have to be tried, what kind of elements of proof were going to have to be met, and exactly what kind of a burden this man was going to have to meet?
I believe the district court certainly did understand that.
The fact is
that consistently throughout the litigation, Johnson was able to put forth his arguments in a clear way. He successfully defended the motions to dismiss. He defended the motions for summary judgment with regard to several of the defendants. He made discovery motions. He made motions in limine. In his writings, he discussed issues of qualified immunity. He discussed deliberate indifference with regard to the correct elements. He discussed whether there was a serious medical need. He discussed the adequacy of treatment, whether his needs were being disregarded. He cited case law for these things. He discussed these things. All throughout the process, he was adequately representing his own needs. The question isn't whether after trial the court looks back and say, well, this is complex, so I'll appoint counsel for the appeal. The question is whether at the beginning of the trial it was reasonable for the district court judge to conclude that this prisoner has the ability of presenting his claims in court. Not whether an attorney would do as good of a job or better, but whether it would be a denial of due process, essentially, for this prisoner to go on his own. And that simply was not the case. And Johnson's conduct at trial bears the district court's decision out. Johnson questioned, for instance, my remaining client, Sirlock, as to what Sirlock knew of the condition, whether the seriousness of the condition, and the response. These are the issues in the deliberate indifference case. Johnson also questioned the doctors as to what the appropriate standard of care is, what is the proper treatment for a reducible inguinal hernia. These questions were put forth. Johnson testified as to the pain and to the care he got. He developed the pertinent issues relating to his deliberate indifference claim at trial. And that all that does is just bears out the district court's decision based on Johnson's conduct throughout the entire litigation, that he knew what he was doing, basically. He identified the correct issues, and he was able to discuss them. And in many cases, this court has upheld the denial of appointment of counsel in similar instances, in deliberate indifference cases brought by prisoners. And again, this case is not horribly complex. There were medical issues, but they weren't horribly complex medical issues.
Is there any discussion about the what the operation would, if it were to go forward, what it would entail, about what different methods of operating on a hernia and what the state of the art is versus what maybe they would do?
That discussion isn't in the record. I don't think there was any testimony.
Well, that's what I'm asking, if that's in the record. Was that brought up at trial, or was it an issue about the risk and the severity versus the risk?
Well, there is testimony that from doctor, I believe Dr. McIntyre, that not all reducible hernias are operated on because there is a question of risk that is looked at on a case-by-case basis. I don't believe that there's testimony specifically that discussion was had with Johnson. I'm not saying that discussion wasn't had, but I didn't see that. I don't recall that in the record from the questioning of the doctors.
Well, as far as we don't know what Johnson, when he went to the doctor, was talking to the doctor for one of these various visits, what was said, but just what's on the record in court, that's all we can go on at this point. Okay.
Given that, I'd like to turn to the defense position. And the DOC defense position broadly is that they were, in this case, entitled to rely on the medical expertise of the prison doctors. There's simply no argument that they weren't. There's nothing to show that they were not entitled to rely on the medical professionals. All of the DOC defendants are lay prison administrators. They do not have medical expertise. They do not have the ability to practice medicine and order or prescribe surgery. In fact, yes, sir.
I wonder if you could tell me a bit about this defendant's Sirlock, am I correctly pronouncing
yes,
name?
Yes, Your Honor.
What did this individual do? Did this individual hold the purse strings?
No. This individual was essentially he was the prison administrator of the health care unit, that's true. Mm-hmm. And so when the doctors would, for instance, recommend surgery, he would be in charge of actually scheduling it.
Would he be in charge of deciding whether or not the doctor's recommendation was valid? Against a manual or against any higher directives from the department or anything of that nature?
His testimony is that he wasn't subject to those things. When the doctors recommended surgery, it would be scheduled. He, as a lay administrator, didn't have the power, the authority, or the ability to say, well, the doctors ordered this surgery, but I don't think I'm going to do it. He didn't have the authority to do that.
No, but could he say, well, the doctor's recommendation doesn't conform to a directive, a manual, something I have from someone higher up in the department. I've got to send this up the line before I can schedule.
There's nothing in the record to indicate that that was the situation.
Who do the doctors report to?
Well, in essence, the doctors are report to the healthcare unit administrator in that way. They don't report in terms of
which is
this guy, yes.
Yeah.
But they don't report to him in terms of You know, the doctors set their own, you know, make their own diagnoses, and they're not governed by any policy with regard to how they diagnose. They just diagnose as they would. And the testimony in the record is that the doctors diagnose the prisoners as they would in private practice. They're not beholden in that way. Okay. Now, it is the case that Sirlak testified that the department uses a definition of elective surgery, which, you know, takes into account certain real
does
world.
Does it take into account persistent pain?
Yes.
How?
The testimony from Sirlak at the trial, at page 46 of this transcript, is specifically that if, for instance, in reference to a reducible hernia, if it becomes an acute issue and is then recommended for surgery, the surgery can be scheduled. An acute issue can be acute pain.
So the acute issue evolves after the doctor's evaluation. So it's defined as acute by the doctor, not by whoever your client is. Is that right? Is that
it's the doctor's diagnosis that it is acute, yes.
Does the regulation, the directive, define acute issue to include persistent pain?
There is no regulation or directive at issue. That is the department. That's how the department works. But
because these are all the issues that if we had had a real trial, we probably would have a record on, right?
No, I don't think it's necessary. He elicited direct testimony. Is there department policy on this? Sirlak testified. He was the one competent to testify on it, and he testified that, you know, we don't have a blanket policy. What we do is, if a surgery, if a condition is such that conservative, non-surgical treatment modalities can be put off, cannot be put off, then the surgery, if recommended, will be performed. If non-surgical conservative treatment can be pursued, it will be pursued. But another essential element of this case, and don't forget, is that Johnson came to Sirlak complaining that his condition had gotten worse. He said, my pain's gotten worse. What did Sirlak do? He referred him to the doctors because he was under continuing observation in case the situation became acute.
Your time has expired, but if you'd like to just summarize up, please go ahead.
Thank you, Your Honor. The record does not show anything approaching a sufficiently culpable state of mind for the DOC defendants in this matter to find them deliberately indifferent. Additionally, it was not unreasonable for the district court to determine that Johnson was capable of presenting his issues at the trial, or that to deny him counsel would be such that to deny him counsel would be an abuse of discretion. Additionally, the evidence bears out that the doctors saw this inmate repeatedly, kept him under observation, and pursued a conservative treatment modality. To the extent that Johnson wants surgery, that's merely a disagreement over the course of treatment, which is not stated a deliberate indifference claim. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Counsel. Counsel?
May it please the Court. I would like to begin on the issue of acute distress. It was actually defined by Dr. McIntyre in his testimony as heart attack or something like that when the person is vomiting and lying on the floor. And when asked about the examination of Mr. Johnson, Dr. McIntyre testified that he did not diagnose Johnson with acute distress, which was vomiting and lying on the floor. So the acute distress that would justify surgery, according to the unwritten policies of the IDOC, would be a very extreme life-threatening situation, and it would completely disregard chronic persistent pain.
With the strangulation issue, did he describe that as being an acute situation?
Yes, the strangulation would be an acute situation. It would be life-threatening. The counsel mentioned that Johnson testified that some prisoners got surgery. However, the record does not support that conclusion. Johnson actually stated that he knew some guys some of whom obtained such surgery, some of whom did not. We do not know if those who obtained the surgery were in acute distress, neither do we know where or when those whom Johnson spoke with obtained the surgery.
Well, I assume they were prisoners. Or is that a wrong assumption? When he referred to these nose guys.
Yes, he actually the line says, I've been in prison, I've known some guys. But we don't know. Johnson had, so during his term of this current term of prison, he was transferred in, you know, between about six prison facilities. We don't know whether that statement has anything to do with Graham's.
Let me follow up on that a minute. If he was how many? He was in several prisons. Is this the only prison where he had the hernia problem?
The problem began in while he was at Graham in 2000. He was transferred in December 2000 to Dixon facility, where he's incarcerated right now.
But is it all at Dixon when he saw these various doctors and they?
Apparently, he saw doctors at Dixon who only who denied the surgery along the same arguments as the Graham physicians did. So it only points out that there is some persistent. Persistent policy within IDOC that does not allow surgery, even though his condition deteriorated, that the hernia grew considerably in size, and it's been almost 5 years since the condition began.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you,
counsel.
Your
did you appear by appointment to the court?
Yes.
Well, we have the deep thanks of the court for your fine brief, and we do also thank your firm for having taken
thank
on
you.
The case. And we thank you, gentlemen, from
thank
the appellees for your very fine presentations.